Hi, everybody. Today is Tuesday, April 29th, 2025, and our friend Colin Wilkerson is back with us. Welcome back.
Good to be with you, Nima. A little late, but otherwise.
Larry, what's going on right now between, in your opinion, what's going on between Pakistan and India? It seems that these are two important countries because they both have nuclear bombs.
Yes.
And this shows how important that is. What's your take on what's going on right now?
First, let me say they seem to have this tendency to do this about every decade or decade and a half. In 2002, they literally scared the bejesus out of Colin Powell, Rich Armitage, George W. Bush, Dick Cheney, Condi Rice, the whole administration, because we thought there was a very distinct possibility they were going to hurl nuclear weapons at one another. You may recall there was a real border clash in which some aircraft engaged each other, were shot down. One thing the Indian Air Force learned was that the Pakistanis and F-16s were pretty good, maybe even better than the Indian pilots and their aircraft. So that didn't work well. India being the bigger country and the big brother and all that kind of thing, nasty big brother. But we actually dispatched Colin and Rich Armitage, the Deputy Secretary of State, and others to Delhi and to Islamabad. And we were appalled at the naivete we saw about nuclear war. We, for example, told them about permissive action links, where you have to have two keys to enable a nuclear weapon, a nuclear warhead. We talked to them at length and gave them many contacts about escalation theory, because it was clear they had not done a lot of thinking about escalation theory. Rich actually asked a question, something like, I think this was of Islamabad. What do you do if the Indians fire 20 weapons? Well, they said, well, we'll fire 40. So then in Delhi, they asked the question, what if they fire 40? What do you do? We'll fire 80. Okay. How do you stop? How do you get to the point where you've killed enough people? Because you're going to kill a hell of a lot of people. And oh, by the way, do you know that our studies show that if you have even a moderate nuclear exchange between you and Pakistan and India, you are probably going to affect adversely for 5 to 10 years, maybe a decade, agriculture in the heartland of the United States of America because of the nuclear winter you're going to create over our country. Have you thought about that? Have you seen these studies? Do you know what these analyses predict with fairly high probability? And they walked down, they stepped down from the perch and things became a little better. And we thought we had convinced them on both sides, hardware and escalation theory, dominance theory, all the things we'd learned during the Cold War, that maybe we wouldn't have one of these again, but here we are again. And we're at another position where they have done something in the conventional standoff that they have constantly with one another, as with China and India. But in this case, of course, there's a behemoth versus a behemoth, and there's not that irrationality of behavior that exists between the Pakistanis and the Indians that goes all the way from the formation of Pakistan forward. So it's worrisome. It's very worrisome. And I'll point this out too. Your listeners may not be aware of all of this. There was recently an enormous flood in Pakistan. I'm sure you realize it. You know about it. And it was the biggest flood probably Pakistan has faced in the modern age. And the reason for that, in essence, is climate. The climate has affected the Himalayan glaciers to the point now where you're going to get deluge followed by drought. And when it becomes drought, that is to say the glaciers are dried up, then you have a major problem that could bring us to the precipice again, an existential precipice, because Pakistan has said it's going to build dams and it's going to hold that water for as long as it possibly can. Understandable, because it's not going to have much water unless it does that. And that robs Western India of all the river flow that they count on for their existence in that part of India. So this is sort of a prelude to this bigger crisis that's coming, caused by the climate crisis. And here we are, even in this lesser circumstance, if you will, but there's still the overhang of the climate crisis here because there's still problems with the water in the rivers. But this is just the preliminary. And even in this preliminary, we're looking at possible exchange of weapons, possible war. This has been a sore point for a long time. I suspect it's never going away. It's going to go away as long as the antagonisms that exist exist, and as long as both are nuclear weapon states. But it needs a calm hand in Islamabad and a calm hand in Delhi, and it needs a calm hand from the place where it isn't going to get a calm hand, probably, Washington, D.C. So I hope that Beijing and Moscow will step in, and Beijing particularly with Islamabad and Moscow with Delhi, and offer their good offices to do the kinds of things we did in 2002, because I don't think the United States, the empire, is capable of doing this sort of thing anymore. We don't have the people who could go over there and talk them down.
Larry, do you think that actually we will learn that China is asking the both countries to just calm down and find some sort of solution for the conflict? But how about the United, you mentioned the United States. Do you think that the Trump administration is concerned about what, concerned of what's going on in between the two countries?
Nima, I can't even tell you that Mike Waltz or Pete Hegseth or Marco Rubio even know anything about these issues that I've just briefly discussed, nor that they have briefed Donald Trump, nor that Donald Trump has asked for a briefing, nor that Donald Trump gives a damn. He is, as I've said many times before, he is so flighty, so mercurial, and his team is so either sycophantic on the one side or infighting on the other. Look at what they're trying to do to Pete Hegseth. They're, internally, they're trying to get rid of Pete Hegseth. And this is a horrible story in itself, because I'm no fan of Pete Hegseth, but I understand the principal reasons why they're trying to get rid of him. I don't agree with any of them. The principal reason they're trying to get rid of him is because he's on Trump's side with regard to a war with Iran. And they want war with Iran. They want it badly. And they've been working with Israel to get it. And they've been war planning with Israel to get it. And now that it looks like it might not come to pass, they're angry. And they want to get rid of Hegseth because he was aid to this. So I don't know, Nima. I don't know that Trump even knows there's a crisis in India and Pakistan.
Here is Larry, the defense minister of Pakistan, had an interview on a British media. They were asking him about the terrorism. And we know that one of the issues right now between the two countries is the terrorism and the terrorist acts. Here is what he said.
You do admit, sir, that Pakistan has had a long history of backing and supporting and training and funding these terrorist organizations.
Well, we have been doing this dirty work for the United States for about three decades, you know, and West, including Britain.
So that's your argument, that
that was a mistake, and we suffered for that. And that is why you are saying this to me. If we had not joined the war against Soviet Union and later on the war after 9/11, Pakistan's track record, you know, was not, you know, an unimpeachable track record.
Defense Minister, I just want to get back to.
Larry, you just.
These are the same things we were hearing in 2002. It was Lashkar-e-Taiba, I think. It was an attack on Pakistan or India, one or the other. I can't remember what. And the accusation of India that was that Pakistan was behind the terrorist attack. It's the same old arguments. And I'm not saying that Pakistan isn't behind terrorist activity in Kashmir and in the vicinity thereof. In fact, all along the border with India. But this is not something to go to nuclear war over. And that's what we had to say in 2002. You know, let's study it. Let's see who was guilty. And we talked it down to the point where they set up committees to examine legally and otherwise who had been at fault, and was there any Pakistan complicity? Was there any Indian complicity? Because there's always the potential. They learn from us, Nima. there's always potential there for false flag operation too. And the false flag operation might not even be an operation that Delhi or Islamabad, the respective capitals, are aware of. It might be some military commander or some provincial civilian official who's stirring the pot for his own purposes. And Delhi's not even aware that they're doing terrorist-like things to stir the pot. Or Islamabad's not aware. My reading of the issues in 2002 was that more often than not, and this wasn't just the one occasion, there were several occasions in the period between 9/11 and 2005. More often than not, Pakistan had a hard time defending itself because the ISI was indeed in there using terrorist organizations to do what it would like to do to India wholesalely, and that is destabilize it. And the ISI knew it was doing that. I mean, it wasn't the fact of some rogue ISI agents in the field. It was in Islamabad. The ISI knew. Now, the question in my mind was always, did the civilian government in Islamabad know what the ISI was doing? Sometimes it looked like they were surprised when a terrorist attack suddenly blossomed in Kashmir, for example, and India started complaining about it.
There is the operation in the Red Sea and against Yemenis. It seems that it's turning into a nightmare for the Trump administration.
How could it be otherwise when you are a president who says you're not at war and you're not responsible for war and you're waging a war against the poor people of Yemen? And you don't acknowledge the fact that you've been waging that war along with your Saudi allies and Emirati allies to a certain extent for a long time. And you can't really get away with saying you're not a president who loves war when you're dropping how many bombs, how many days of bombs on this poor country, Yemen, and you're dropping them on principally civilians, as far as I can tell. You may have smart bombs, but your intelligence sucks because everything I'm hearing from Yemen and everything I'm seeing is the predominant number of casualties coming from our bombs are civilians. Civilians. Now, we will be first in line to holler and scream that they have weapons in their hands or that when a Reaper drone looks down and takes a photograph or whatever, that there are weapons in the hands of the people that are dying. Everyone in Yemen has an AK-47 or an M16 equivalent rifle. I mean, there's no one in Yemen who doesn't reach behind their door and have a weapon. It's a very dangerous place and has been a very dangerous place for a long time. So to say that you killed that person because they had a weapon or because they were in a almost a Loya Jirga type celebration or whatever, and you saw them all in a circle and you dropped mordants in there and killed a bunch of them because you saw weapons leaning against the wall or whatever, is nonsense because you're killing a lot of civilians. And we're doing this day in and day out. And we've been doing it for quite a while. I listened to someone today talking about how, why are we still doing this? And this person was basically right in the message he was conveying, but he was saying, why are we still doing this? Because there hasn't been a commercial ship hit in the Red Sea for 4 months. Well, I wanted to ask, and I'm checking now, has there been a commercial ship in the Red Sea in the last 4 months? Because that's the Houthis' purpose, is to keep them from going through there. And my last word from the Pentagon was that the insurers and the shippers had said no. They got better things to do. Going around the Horn is a little bit more expensive, but it's not all that much more expensive. And let's face it, the tariffs in the world right now are perturbating the world economy majorly anyway. So they're not sailing through the Red Sea. So the fact that the commercial shipping has not been hit in the Red Sea for 4 months, I don't even know if that's right, but that's what he contended. It doesn't mean much if it's not there. The only thing there are things like the aircraft carrier off which the F-18 and its tractor fell. So, you know, it's still a target rich area, but the targets are principally U.S. warships. And who's responsible for that?
There is an article in CNN. On CNN, it says Houthis' successful targeting of U.S. drones is hampering Trump's mission to kill group's senior leadership. Larry, when you look at the way that they're trying to kill the leadership of Ansar Allah, let's assume that they're successful in their way, they're trying to do that.
Yeah, we learned from those brothers.
What change that would bring to this scene?
Not any more change than has been brought to the situation in Israel with their decapitating constantly, whatever it might be, the political apparatus of Hamas, the war-making apparatus, the Hezbollah apparatus. It doesn't change anything except, and we found this out during our war on terror, so to speak. We found out that oftentimes, if you kill the leader, you got a worse person coming in to take charge, worse in terms of your own interests. And one of the most glaring instances there was when we put Osama bin Laden to run, you know, put him on the run and in caves and such, and finally got him. Amin al-Zawahiri took over al-Qaeda, and he was a lot more bloodthirsty than bin Laden. And so we had other attacks in other regions put on by al-Qaeda that were Zawahiri's real feat. So you don't know what you're going to get, but you probably have at least a 50-50 chance of getting a worse leader in the case, in terms of your own interest, in the case of killing, decapitating terrorist leadership. So it is at best a tactic fraught with potential dangers. And in this case, I think it's a lot associated with the use of the drone, which we became, especially the Reaper. I should throw the Predator in there too, but Reaper now is the principal one. We became so accustomed in Afghanistan and to a certain extent in Iraq and other places like Somalia to flying these things with virtual impunity that now that the Houthis have figured out how to, I think we're up to 22 or 23 that they've gotten now, if we believe the record, at quite a sum of money. We're talking about $1 billion. And, you know, if you can't get the ISR properly, then no matter how precise your missile is that might come down from the drone or indeed from an F-16 or an F-18 or whatever, is no more dependable than an iron bomb. Because if your intelligence is bad, you're going to drop it on a religious ceremony, or you're going to drop it on a funeral, or you're going to drop it on some other civilian exercise that has nothing to do with the Al-Ansar in particular. And maybe you'll get an occasional Houthi leader, but it's just not a very effective way to fight. And yet we're spending millions, if not billions of dollars on it. And look at what we're doing with our carriers and look at what we're exposing our carriers to. I listened to Scott, for example, talking about what happened in the sea. With, we don't have carrier battle groups anymore. We don't have enough ships. You know, Scott used that term CBBG, carrier battle group. That's the term I grew up with. That's the term Scott grew up with, because we grew up with what was a CVBG, a carrier CV battle group, BG. And that meant you had quite a few escorts, including submarines, usually attack subs, but occasionally you'd have a ballistic missile sub that would use your screen as a hiding place. We don't have that anymore because we don't have the ships and the boats. So we have strike groups. So Truman or Vinson or Roosevelt or whomever it might be goes in there with a few escorts and that's it. One of the things that I learned from a Navy admiral retired, I don't think an active duty guy would write this, in the very prestigious Naval Institute Proceedings magazine, was that because of what I'm talking about right now, if we lost a carrier and we put 5,000 souls in the water, 2,000 of them may be dead immediately, sunk, killed with the ship. But if 2,000 or 3,000 were still in the water, we don't have enough berth space on the escort ships to rescue them, to pick them up. No one's thought about that. And I'm sure this Navy admiral, glad he was retired already, he probably got excoriated for writing that. But imagine sailing into the Taiwan Strait and having a hypervelocity missile and maybe a 65 centimeter Wacoming torpedo at the same time or roughly the same time hit a carrier and sink it just like that, which is what it would do. It'd go down just like that fast. You'd probably have a couple thousand men and women in the water. Now you can't rescue them because you don't even have the berth space to pick them up, if you could even pick them up. Now, the reference to that, of course, is World War II, because that's the last time we had lots of carriers and we took a lot of damage and had to rescue people in the water. And people say, well, that's not a good model, but that's the only model we have. You're going to have people in the water who are in burning fuel. You're going to have people who are wounded in the water. And you have some people who have got their life stuff on and they're floating and they're sound people. They're not wounded or anything else, but you can't rescue them. Because you haven't got the space. You can't even put them on the deck space of the escorts because it's a strike group now, not a battle group. Fewer ships. And that's what we have in the Red Sea. And by the way, that is the most, that and the Persian Gulf are the two bodies of water that are lake-like, if you will, you know, inland seas that are the most dangerous possible place to put a carrier. In fact, any skipper in my time in the Pacific Command, for example, back in the 80s and the early 90s, any skipper who put a carrier in that confined water would probably be relieved because it's just too dangerous for them. Too dangerous. Mines, submarines, missiles, attack aircraft, all. It's too dangerous. It's too much of a target in such a confined body of water. We're going to pay. We are going to pay. Take my word for it. We're going to pay. I'm going to be the first one to rue the day those sailors are dead, but we're going to pay. If we attack Iran, we'll pay dearly.
Larry, do you see the potential in the administration to change its policy toward Yemen, or they're going to double down?
Well, generally speaking, what we have been doing now for about 20 years plus, Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, Syria, you name Somalia, you name it, is reinforcing failure, not backing away from it. We're doing that to a certain extent in Ukraine, and we're certainly doing that in Israel. We're reinforcing failure in Israel. There is every reason to expect that what Haaretz said in a headline yesterday or this morning, Jews killing Jews, is going to happen, that we're going to have a civil war in Israel. And it's going to all be compelled, really long-term, substantially, by our inability to control them or lack of desire to control them because they're out of control now, out of control. There are segments of their society now that are just bristling with civil war type attitudes. And the IDF is sorely pressed. It's in trouble. It's too exposed. It's got lots of people who don't agree with what it's doing, including some of its high-ranking general officers. And it's got an idiot in charge of them, Bibi Netanyahu. And I say that carefully because he's a smart man. He's an astute politician. But when it comes to his own survival, he has put that above and beyond Israel's survival, even. And he's putting his state's survival, very essence of his state, in jeopardy. And he just keeps driving on. He just keeps pushing on, as if he can't lose sight of the fact that he goes to jail if he ever stops. And the latest thing I'm hearing is that he and Cirillo, the Central Command commander, got together, as did the leadership of the IDF with them, and they planned this attack, this joint attack by the United States and Israel on Iran. And I'm hearing that one of the reasons Hegseth is anathema, if you will, in the Pentagon now, is because that group of people who were allied with and sympathetic with Cirillo and want it to happen are trying to get rid of Hegseth, because he's lining up with Trump in terms of not wanting that to happen, not wanting the joint attack of U.S. Israel against Iran to transpire. I may have gotten the name wrong there, the unified commander. I haven't looked over the unified command commanders in such a long time, but it's the central command commander. He's only got 3 or 4 months left in the job, I think, but he really wants his war. And this is another thing. The Defense Department and the Unified Command commanders have become enormously powerful in the American security envelope. And no four-star general or admiral of any service commanding any regional area in the Unified Command Plan of the empire should have that much power. No regional commander should be leading the United States into war. The only person who's supposed to do that is the president of the United States.
Larry, you mean that while they're going to attack Iran, while the talks are happening between the United States and Iran?
I don't think so, and I hope not. But now this could have been, if I wanted to put a positive spin on it, it could be Waltz, the National Security Advisor, who definitely wants an attack. And Rubio, who is of that mind, and some of the members of the Congress who are of that mind, most notably Lindsey Graham from South Carolina, it could have been using them as tools to try and put more pressure on Iran. Witkoff is involved in negotiations that I think that Trump has a direct hand in, probably the only ones that he does have a direct hand in. And Witkoff seems to be doing exactly what he should be doing. Calm, mild-mannered, diplomatic, pursuing a deal. But these other people don't want it. And if Trump is astute enough to use these other people's machinations within his own administration to put pressure on Iran, that's one thing. But that's dangerous business. That's very dangerous business. If he's not aware of it, or if he's only peripherally aware of it, or he doesn't give a damn about it and he just lets it go on, that's dangerous too, because you never know when the bureaucracy is going to pick up the pieces, as it were, and head off in the direction that you didn't want them to head off in this case, war with Iran. So I think Witkoff is doing what Trump wants him to do, what Witkoff wants to do, and he's succeeding. But there's a lot of alignment of forces in Washington that don't want them to succeed. And part of those forces are trying to get rid of Hegseth.
Yeah. Here is, Larry, here is what Netanyahu said in terms of the deal between Iran and the United States.
A deal that works is a deal which removes Iran's capacity to enrich uranium for nuclear weapons. By the way, the only reasons you enrich uranium is to have nuclear weapons. There are dozens and dozens of countries who have civilian nuclear programs, and they don't enrich uranium. So Iran is constantly thinking, well, we have to find a reason why we're putting these things in bunkers under mountains, maybe for radioisotopes, right, for medicine, or for nuclear submarines. Give me a break. They enrich uranium for one reason and one reason only, and that's to make nuclear weapons, which they intend to use to destroy my country and threaten America. Once they have the weapons of delivery, ballistic missiles, ICBMs, intercontinental ballistic missiles, they will threaten every city in the United States.
Notice he's speaking in English. He's not speaking to an Israeli audience. He's speaking to his English audience. And he's even using idiomatic English, which means he is in control. And listen to what he's saying. Don't you have nuclear weapons, Bibi? Are you a signatory to the safeguards agreement, to the additional protocol? Are you a member of the non-proliferation treaty? Bibi, who's the danger from a nuclear weapon point of view to the Middle East? Bibi, who's the danger? You are. This is a genius at turning lies into truth and truth into lies. He's a genius at it. And the sad thing is how many Americans, including those in the security establishment leadership, believe him.
When he talks about Iran attacking the United States, what's in it for Iran to attack the United States? What's the main goal?
Disappearing. Disappearing from the Levant permanently. I mean, you know, he goes on and on about deterrence and why he has to have a nuclear weapon, an undeclared nuclear weapon, or two or three or 100 or so. and is not a member of the NPT, not a member of any of the other agreements. He goes on and on about that and goes on and on about Iraq attacking us, but he doesn't say anything about why he has nuclear weapons. He has nuclear weapons, so Tehran will disappear too. And Tehran knows that. Why else would Tehran ever make a decision to build a nuclear weapon? To try and set that off and at least balance it. Because at any time Bibi wants to, he can make Tehran disappear. And he knows that.
The main message in this talk is that Iran doesn't need to enrich uranium and they can get it from somewhere else. But how, the way that he's picturing the situation is, he shows that he doesn't want a deal between Iran and the United States.
Absolutely. You're spot on correct. Look at what the JCPOA did. It had provisions for putting enriched uranium more so than 3.7 or so percent in another country. And if it were necessary for something that was really cutting edge technology, cancer therapy, for example, you bring it back in from the other country with the other country and the IAEA supervising that transshipment. That was all part of the JCPOA. So there are things you can do that will allow you to go beyond the 3.7 and to have enriched uranium for other uses if you can prove you have those other needs. And the JCPOA took care of that. And this new agreement could take care of that too, if you wanted to. Bibi knows all that. He just does not want anything to detract from his ability to stay in power. And the last bugbear he has to make sure he stays in power is Iran. And getting a war going with Iran between Israel and the United States and Iran would be the denouement of a magnificent career. That's the way Bibi looks at it. And the savior of his life in terms of prison time and so forth, because once he eliminates Iran with the United States' help, no one's going to get rid of him. He will be king. Now he's sitting on a powder keg, as I said before. He's sitting on a powder keg. I don't know if he realizes it or not, but this business of what the head of Shin Bet and the courts are doing, what the people who are really angry at him over no concern for the hostages at all, I'm sure you've seen that expose that's making its way around the internet. I saw it on YouTube this morning, watched it all the way through a couple of times, about how absolutely criminal Blinken, Sullivan, and Biden were with regard to Netanyahu. How at every juncture where Biden could have called him back, all Biden did was push him forward. Where at every juncture where the United States had an opportunity to cut down on the killing a bit, Biden just opted out, and Blinken and Sullivan were right there with him the whole time. The names I was calling them weren't harsh enough. They were aiding and abetting Netanyahu and everything he's done in Gaza and ultimately in the other places too, like Lebanon. So the United States' guilt in this is just humongous. I don't know if Trump understands that. He would be better positioned, but he can't do it because of what he set himself up as with regard to Israel. But he'd be better positioned to say not that Ukraine was Biden's war, because that's a lie. Trump was president from 2016. Let's face it. You were there when some of the most horrible machinations took place with NATO. So it is your war, Donald. But he would be perfectly correct to say that Gaza's not his war. It's Biden, Blinken, and, what did I call them? Blinken, Nod, and Nudge, Victoria Nuland. It was their war. But he won't do that. He won't back away from that. Instead, he's coming up with these fancy plans about how to turn Gaza into a seaside resort that he can build hotels in. It's crazy. He could have gained so much stature by coming in and telling Miriam Adelson, for example, thanks for your money and getting me elected, but now I'm going to put an end to that slaughter in the Middle East. I'm going to just put an end to it. I'm going to tell Netanyahu he's got two choices, and both of them are the same thing. Stop, or I'll make you stop. I mean, he could have gained all kinds of international stature and all kinds of political stature domestically had he done something like that. Because the American people are turning to the tune of 57, 58, 59, 60% now against Israel. And it's just going to increase. It's not going to go down. It's just going to increase. And this expose on Biden, Blinken, and Sullivan and what they actually did in the time that they were in office from October 7th to the time they were out of office is just going to add to the fire.
Larry, when you look at historians and the society of Israel, from Yitzhak Rabin right now to Netanyahu, and the changes that have happened during these years, and coming to a point that Netanyahu is capable of risking everything for his position, do you think that the Israeli society is feeling this sort of difference, this sort of changes that have happened during the years, and how deep they're just damaging everything in that region?
I think there's an innate recognition amongst a segment of the Israeli portion of the Israeli citizenry, you know, the 7 million that are actually Jews. I don't know if it's significant enough to, let me put it bluntly, save the state of Israel as a liberal democracy at this particular point in time. I just don't know if it's enough. I know there are people there who understand the depth of Israel's crisis right now and want to do something to try and extract it from that depth. But they don't have political means to do it because the body politic of Israel that would be necessary to cast out the devil, so to speak, and to bring in someone who is willing to work for peace is not strong enough. It's not deep enough. It's not profound enough. So I don't know how you, in what pretends to be a democracy, but is rapidly turning into an autocracy with him as the dictator, I don't know how you reach in there and find a mechanism to avoid civil war and the kind of turmoil that comes out of that, which will change things, probably dramatically, but not necessarily positively, and do it peacefully. In other words, I don't know how you get rid of Bibi and find someone who is more like a Yitzhak Rabin, for example. I don't know how you do that in Israel. And I don't know that there's enough people in Israel who want to do that. It's kind of like the times of old with the Israelites, when you see them marching off a cliff and there are leaders and prophets amongst them who tell them the cliff is there. Tell them that the cliff is there because they dug it, built it, whatever. And they've avoided the Torah. They've avoided their God. They're worshiping mammon, all this other kind of thing. And all of a sudden, and that's what Netanyahu represents. Netanyahu is not religious. He doesn't have a religious bone in his body. He's using people like Ben-Gavir and Smotrich and others who do have religious bones that are corrupt as hell for his own political purposes. But every time this has happened in the past to, you know, the Israelites, it's always been a case of I'm going over the cliff, whether it's Nebuchadnezzar destroying them and enslaving them and putting them into the diaspora, or whether it's modern day Israel, where it started every war it's ever been in. Israel, since 48, Israel has started every war it's ever been in. 67 war, 73 war, and certainly the ones subsequent. Israel is just built for war and built for destroying the people whose land it's stealing. And if you're going to come to grips with that and make some kind of agreement over how you're going to change in order to accommodate not only the Israeli Jews in the region, but also those within the Israeli state who are non-Jewish, make them first-class citizens, in other words, and accommodate the people whom you were exterminating in order to steal their land with their own state, that is a hell of a shift of thought and purpose. And I don't know if it's possible. I really don't know if it's possible. I'd be a way too over the top optimist to say that I think it is possible. My realist bones tell me that what's going to happen is what I've been saying all along, the destruction of the state of Israel. That's what's happened historically, and I think that's what's going to happen again.
It's so amazing, Larry, that they have concluded that Pete Hegseth is not going to support them in any sort of attack on Iran.
Isn't it?
Trying to remove him. So how did they come to this conclusion, in your opinion? Just because of those talks that have been leaked into the media that Pete Hegseth together with J.D. Vance? I think, how about J.D. Vance? What do they want to do with J.D. Vance?
I think J.D. Vance is protected to a certain extent by what John Garner called the job that's not worth warm spit. He's vice president. Vice president is not a very powerful position, unless you happen to be Dick Cheney alongside a president who's a novice. Dick Cheney revolutionized the office of vice president. But the traditional role of the vice president is to make visits, to go to funerals, things like that. It's not a powerful position. And I don't think Trump wants him to be a powerful vice president. So he's not. So they're not so concerned about him. But the Secretary of Defense is secretary of the most powerful institution in the American empire. Going to now get, and this we just finished parsing closely, probably, all things considered, $2 trillion in the next outlays. You heard me, $2 trillion. And that's throwing everything that's being spent on national security and the interest payments on our now $1 trillion plus dollar annual debt that associate with national security expenditures into a bucket. And we're saying we're spending, the empire spending $2 trillion on its national security instrument. That's a powerful, powerful, powerful place. So you are after Hegseth. And let me tell you what I think are three different segments within the Pentagon that are after him. We discussed the one that wants to go to war with Iran along with Israel. That's one that wants to unseat him because they see him as being Trump's sycophant or whatever with regard to that. Two, they think he's a terrible manager, and they've got some proof of that already. So they want to get rid of him because there's 600,000 people whose jobs are threatened throughout the United States by him, either directly or indirectly. And three, they don't like the fact that these are different groups of people, but they happen to be aiming at the same thing, unseating Hegseth. The third group, the third group is that group which sees him shifting major amounts of funding out of this huge budget the Defense Department gets from legacy contractors like Lockheed Martin and Northrop Grumman over to contractors like Palantir, Anduril, and other Silicon Valley-like avant-garde, cutting-edge contractors, which Hegseth has made no bones about. He wants to do that. He wants to shift as much as 8 to 10% of a $1 trillion budget over to them. They don't like that at all. That's threatening their jobs. It's threatening four-star generals' ability to walk out of the Pentagon after retirement and get a $600,000, $700,000, $800,000, $900,000 a year job or more with Lockheed or with one of the other bigger contractors. So those three elements don't like Hegseth at all. And they're working, not necessarily together, but they're working on the same purpose, get Hegseth out of there. They're leaking on him. They're telling stories about him.
Larry, the conflict in Ukraine, it seems as time goes by, Donald Trump is getting so desperate to get a deal as soon as possible. But on the part of Russians, that doesn't seem to be the case, as because they have a lot of concern about what's going on in Ukraine, what would be the outcome of a Ukrainian settlement. And recently we had, Donald Trump had a meeting with Zelensky in Italy.
The one in the Vatican?
Yeah, exactly. That Macron wanted to be part of that, which was, he was rejected. Here is what Donald Trump is feeling about Zelensky. And he's talking about the way that he sees Zelensky.
Things were said, like when Zelensky was in the Oval Office, I was talking about getting it done, and he starts screaming, but we need security, meaning security after the fact. I said, security? I don't even know if we can get this deal done. He's asking for more, just more and more and more. And he doesn't have the cards, as you know, because you see what's happening over there. He doesn't have the cards. So hopefully he's going to get it done, because I don't believe that Vladimir Putin would be doing this for anybody else but me. A lot of people have said it too. I think he had the idea of going all the way through. I think he's willing to make a deal. And I would say thus far, he's been easier to deal with than Zelensky.
Yeah. He feels that Vladimir Putin is easier to deal with than Zelensky. And Zelensky has asked for more weapons and intelligence and all of that in the latest meeting they had. How, Larry, do you think, when you look at Zelensky and his manner, and the way that he's somehow trying to play with the administration in the United States, do you think it's all about him and his administration, or Europeans, as we saw, Macron wanted to be part of the talks in Italy, are somehow behind the scene and preparing Zelensky for the talks, for the negotiations, for the bargaining process with Donald Trump?
I think there's no question that the Europeans are trying to screw the pooch. In other words, they are trying to stop, halt the progress that Trump alleges he wants to make. And I think Zelensky is taking advantage of that wherever and whenever he can. But let's face something here up close and personal. Donald Trump said he wanted to end this war. Donald Trump says he has a special relationship with Putin, that relationship has deepened and become even more profound, perhaps, over this. That conversation there sort of suggested that, over this business of stopping the war. Then do it. And the first thing you need to do, Donald, is to look at Zelensky and say, you will not get another bullet, another beam, another satellite overflight, another intelligence tidbit from the United States of America. And furthermore, if the Europeans tell you that they'll give you something like that, first of all, they don't have the capacity to give you what we could give you. And second, if they do, I will punish them. I will find a way to punish them. It won't be just tariffs. And I'll make that clear to them. So you're in a really, really hard place, Mr. Z. You need to stop this war. You need to pay attention to me, and you need to follow my lead, because we're going to stop this war. I've got the Russian president exactly where I want him, and I know what he wants. And by the way, Mr. Zelensky, you don't want anything that he wants, but you're going to have to accept everything that he wants. And that includes Crimea, and that includes no NATO presence whatsoever on your soil, nor no hint of NATO membership in your future. And it includes a declaration of clarion quality about Ukraine's neutrality. And it includes him having those four provinces out there that you don't want him to have, and maybe a little bit more. And if you delay any, a lot more. You understand, Mr. Z? Now, if you want to come to Moscow with me and sit behind me and listen to the conversation we're going to have to shut this whole thing down, come right along. If you don't, stay home. But if you make a mess in my rear as I'm in Moscow or wherever dealing with the final steps here, I'll ensure that you have no future. Understand that, young man? I mean, that's what he's got to do. And then he's got to go to the Russians and say it's over. And it's over on your principles and your wishes. Maybe we can squeak something out here and squeak something out here, because I'm the man who's the art of the deal, man. You know, you got to give me something. You got to give me something. Give me a little something here. Recognize Kosovo or something like that. You got to do something. That's what it's going to take if you're going to move fast to an end that's beneficial to all of Europe, despite Starmer, despite Macron, despite Merz, all of whom are going. They do not have the support of their people. Look at Starmer in Germany. They're already demonstrating about the Taurus missile. They don't want that missile going, and Starmer's not going to be in charge for very long. The AfD is going to maybe not build up a strong enough coalition to offset his ability to orchestrate things within the crazy German system, but they're certainly going to demonstrate enough non-popular support that he's going to have a difficult time ruling, if at all. So it's changing rapidly in Europe, maybe not rapidly enough for Trump to keep them from poisoning something ultimately, but I think with the right threats here and the right threats there, he can keep that to a minimum. And his biggest threat is Zelensky, of course, in that regard. But if he deals with him the way I've just described or something remotely like that and gets it on with Putin and Lavrov, should be over. But I don't expect any of that. I don't expect any of that because I don't think Donald Trump can keep his mind on one object and one purpose and one strategy long enough to do it. I think he's all over the map constantly. He can't concentrate on any one thing. And he's got a circus around him of people who have different beliefs about major issues than he. So how the hell do you get anything accomplished with that environment around you? He's scary. He's frightening, really. I mean, truly, he's frightening. And if I were Putin or I were any Iranian involved in the negotiations there, or if I were Witkoff carrying all these things out and this huge burden on my shoulders for my president, Witkoff must know something about Trump that I don't see or don't know, because I can't understand how a man like Witkoff could keep beavering away in the trenches for a man like Trump, if Trump is what he appears to be to the rest of us, a mercurial agent who has an inability to concentrate anything long enough to bring about a solution. That's scary. That's frightening. And it goes throughout the issues from terrorists. You see what happened in Canada, of course. We changed the whole Canadian political scene. Donald Trump changed the whole political scene in Canada. Whoops. All of a sudden, you've got the whole situation reversed, and you got a new president or prime minister, whatever they're calling them now in Canada, that you didn't expect to have 6 months ago. And it's all because of the anti-Trump movement that's developed in Canada. And I think it's good for Canada. I kind of like this guy. He makes a lot of sense when he talks.
Larry, it seems that one of the concerns on the part of Russia is the Ukrainian army. Dmitry Peskov, Kremlin spokesman, said that Kiev is not in charge, doesn't have full control over its own army, its own military.
When has it ever? I mean, if you really want to parse it, Putin's right to a certain extent about the Nazis. He's right to a certain extent about all the things that were happening from 2005 all the way up to 2014 and then sped up, and that were betrayals of either words made by NATO or by the United States or a NATO capital to Russia, or agreements actually signed, all fabricated in order to get Ukraine in a better position to fight Russia. So how do you deal with a side that has been so duplicitous when all you're doing is trying to protect the security of your CSTO, your country, whatever? I do believe that that's what Putin's purpose was in starting the special military operation. I don't think he had any choice. I don't condone the aggression, but at the same time, as a military professional, I understand why he did what he did. It was an existential threat to Russia from his perspective, looking at Russia's history and looking at what was happening and looking at what NATO was going to do in Ukraine, and Ukraine being a NATO member. And the expansion just continuing and continuing. Putin didn't have any choice. So now we're putting an end to that. And that's part of the element that wants Hegseth gone. That's part of the element that wants Trump gone, because they want that war, which is their war, Biden's war, Blinken's war, Sullivan's war, as much as Gaza was. They want that war to go on until they've won and Russia collapses. They still want that. And Trump's up against that, and Hegseth is up against that. And that's some of the uniformed military too. So you're Putin looking at this and you're saying to yourself, good God almighty, how do I deal with these people? Or you're Lavrov. How do I deal with these people? Here's the man I'm dealing with. His name is Witkoff, and he's a real estate agent from New York, or a real estate salesman from New York, and he's Trump's good friend. Okay, I can deal with it. What's Rubio's role? Rubio, Secretary of State. Oh, okay. So I'm dealing with Witkoff, though. Okay. All right. I'm okay with that. Whatever you want to do, but let's get this war over. And then you're faced with the fact that you can't get the war over. And you've invested a lot of blood and treasure in it. as has Ukraine, but Ukraine was doing it on behalf of the United States and secondarily on behalf of NATO, not on behalf of itself, except those young men and women who went out there in the trenches and fought for their soil. And that makes it even more tragic. They died too, and their death was just as painful as those Russians who died. And they died for a lie. They died for a lie, and they died for a leader who is a liar. And they died for leaders ultimately in the empire who were liars, Biden, Blinken, and Sullivan to lead the pack. Now Trump's trying to say, I'm a truth teller, and I divest myself of all that. Well, you were there for 4 years, and you supported everything that was going on in Ukraine during that time. Ah, some of it was very nefarious. And part of the duplicity I'm now objecting to, if I'm Putin, I don't know how you deal with this from the other side. You just try to get what you've won through blood and treasure and leave. And then how do you go to building a new security architecture in Europe and bringing Russia into that architecture and having a whole new Europe in terms of security? How do you do that? How do you go from this rancor and the disgust that Putin and Lavrov and people like them in Russia must have for the West, it must be deep and profound, to a better world afterwards, even 9 or 10 years down the road? To me, that's the huge question. I mean, you could get this stopped in terms of the killing and in terms of the absolutely senseless war. You could get it stopped, but how do you reconcile? How do you reconcile? And Putin's got that concern to worry about too. How does he think that once it's stopped, quote unquote, Ukraine won't reopen it every time he turns around on some aspect of the border? They won't reopen it. I don't see Russia doing that. That's what we say. Oh, Russia will start this over again. They'll come in. Oh, they'll come into Estonia or Latvia or Lithuania. Or my God, they'll come into Poland or whatever. That's pure poppycock. And if it were to happen, it would be because something went wrong in the agreement and Putin sees duplicity again.
Larry, Sergey Lavrov said that Russia will develop relations with the United States, but not at the cost of its existing partners.
What was that again now?
But not at the cost of its existing partners. They're not going to sacrifice their partners. They're talking about Iran and China, maybe.
Yeah, yeah.
They're not going to sacrifice them for the sake of a better relationship with the United States.
Right. It's a very potent statement when you think about Iran for a minute. You know, the planes are flying over the Israeli, probably caused fire near Bandar Abbas. The Russian planes are flying every hour over it, dropping water and chemicals immediately. It reminded me of what we did when the earthquake hit, where was it, Bam, in Iran, 2006, I think it was. And George W. Bush, Colin Powell went over there and said, we've got to help. And Bush said, already on the way. Got the firefighters, got the search dogs, got the parties, you know, the teams of police and everything already going. And we were already flying help to Iran. And they sent us nice notes afterwards telling us, thank you for all the help that we gave them. And we did. Enemy is an enemy, but they were in... If memory serves, some 30,000 people or something like that. It was a terrible situation. Russia's there just like that now. Russia is the United States now. They're over there. They're flying planes and dropping water and chemicals and everything, trying to help the Iranians fight this fire, which I have no doubt the Israelis started. So Russia is the new humanitarian in the world now. Russia is the country that rushes off to help its friends and its allies in whatever dire circumstance they might get into. Isn't that something? It's shifted. It's shifted. We are the country that's backing the murderer in the Levant, and Russia's the country that's putting out fires at Bandar Abbas. That's not the image the empire likes.
I think there is a decision to make for the administration, for the Trump administration. Do they want a confrontation? Because the message that Russia is sending is so it's so open, and there is no mystery behind it. They're talking about, you want to participate, you want to cooperate, you want to go against us. And do you think that the Trump administration, with what we've seen so far, they're going to lean toward the, somehow some sort of cooperation with Russia, Iran, China? Is, do you see the potential there, or you see the movement that you mentioned in terms of Pete Hegseth that is happening right now? They're trying to remove him. They're trying to maybe then go after J.D. Vance if he's, if they feel that he's going to be so much influential in the decisions of the administration. These people, what do they want? Do they want cooperation? Do they want confrontation? Do they care about the foreign policy of the United States or the Israeli first? They just say Israel is first for us.
Well, that's the question of the hour, I think. There is a significant contingent of the American cognoscenti, if you will. The Soviets used to call it the nomenklatura, you know, the sort of the deep state. That's a Turkish term originally, of course, the deep state. There is a segment of that fabric of America that really rankles over the end of the Cold War not being a complete and utter devastating triumph. And they think it should be revisited and made so. And Russia, of course, stands in the way of that first and foremost, but China ultimately, and Iran's a little impediment out there. They want to see all of these powers kneel and kiss the toe of the empire. And they're powerful people, and they're moneyed people, and they're all around the government in every segment, facet, and corner of the government. And they will not go away into a quiet night. They will, you know, mess up everything they possibly can. Sometimes they're neoconservatives, sometimes they're conservative conservatives, sometimes they're radical conservatives, if that's not an oxymoron. But they're there. They've always been in our body politic, but they're there now big time because the Cold War generated them and put them on their pedestals and in their positions of power. And they do not want to go away. And this movement that I've described to you, which is inexorable, of power eking out of the West, back across Europe and into the East where it originated, with the magnet being China. If you saw Chaz Freeman's Community Church of Boston presentation, where he put that slide up there of all the things China's ahead in and the one or two that we're ahead in, yeah, then you understand the disparity that's developing financially, economically, and power-wise in general between that end of the world and our end of the world, not to mention the fact that 4 out of 5 people on the globe live in that end of the world and not in this end of the world. That's happening. And they don't like this at all, and they want to stop it. And they don't know where Trump is. They don't know where he is in it. They knew where Joe Biden was. Joe Biden was an ally of them par excellence. So was Jake Sullivan and Anthony Blinken, and Israel was the tool that they used to make that alliance solid. Now that alliance is even fraying, even with Trump and his beholden nature to Miriam Adelson and the AIPAC and the lobby and everything else. It's still fraying. Netanyahu is the principal frayer of it. But they want that to stop immediately and power to come back to the West. There's another group of people who see it as what it is and want to accommodate it and want to do exactly what you said. They want to be what Sergei Lavrov and Wang Yi are all the time talking about. They want to be ASEAN-like. They want the world to be ruled not by military power, but by financial and economic power that everyone shares in. That's a very small group, and it's mostly an intellectual group right now. It's not possessed of too many think tanks, and it's not possessed of too many instruments of traditional power in the West, but it is a group. And then you've got a third group that doesn't know what the hell it wants. And that's the unwashed masses, if you will. they're the people you poll, and you find out they're here, they're there, and they're everywhere. I don't know that anybody can get the one group defeated roundly and the other two groups together, democratically speaking, and thus leaders and power coming out of that group that works on accommodation, collaboration, and comedy, and uses the two crises that are both existential facing us as tools to do that. Nuclear weapons with no treaties and proliferating. And look at India and Pakistan right now, for example, and the climate crisis. But we have to. We have to. That side knows it. That side, the East, knows it. They know everything I've just said. They know the problems with the West. They know what has to happen in order to, you know, save the planet, if you will, from nukes and from the climate crisis. And they see us as a tremendous impediment to it. They don't want a war with us to erase that impediment, because they realize a war with us to do that would do it. It would bring about the Holocaust that they're trying to prevent. So they got to be very careful. Wang Yi, Sergei Lavrov, Putin, all these people, I don't care how they were put in power. It gives me no consequence of worry whatsoever how they were put in power. It's how they lead. It's how they face the globe. It's how they instruct their people. It's how they bring their country along. They are in that mold. Maybe it's because they know they've won. Maybe it's because they know we're on the way out. But we could do a lot of damage on the way out. And they know that too, I think, especially Xi Jinping and Wang Yi and Sergei Lavrov and Putin and probably Modi and others. They understand that. They got their own problems too, like Modi. Local problems. But if we don't solve that in this country, make a decision one way or the other, you know what I think will happen. I've said it before. We will fight this to the bitter nuclear end. And we have as many nuclear warheads and are going to build $2 trillion more over the next 15 years, God forbid, as anybody else. And, you know, we could do it. We could arrest this entire inexorable shift of power back from the West to the East, where it originated 5,000 years ago, with nuclear weapons. The problem is we'd be doing it finally, ultimately, forever. And that's not good.
Yeah.
But I don't put such a move past Netanyahu in the tactical sense. And I don't put such a move beyond the empire in a strategic sense, should it suddenly realize one day that, oh, I'm in a war with China and I'm losing. Or, oh, I'm in a war with Iran, Russia, and China and I'm losing. I think I'll stop the war.
Thank you so much, Larry, for being with us today. Great pleasure.
Good to be with you.
As always.
I apologize again for being late.
Problem at all. See you on Friday. You remember that.
Yeah, Larry Johnson, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Looking forward.
See you. Bye bye.
We'll have three of the brightest minds on the planet together.
Yeah.
Take care.
Take care.
Bye bye.